So hey everybody, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. We're very excited to be able to talk to Hollis Watkins, who was the chair of the conference of the 50th commemoration of Mississippi Summer. And in listening to this morning, I realized that you both make history and study history. And we want a new generation of young Black and Latino kids in particular to have a sense of your history. So let me start with, what was the defining moment in your political development before Mississippi 64?
I would say the defining moment in my history came when my father said to me, "Always remember, son, that you are just as much or as important as anybody else. And you should always stand up for the truth and that which is right, even if you're the only one standing." That's what gave rise to my looking at all of the things that was wrong, all of the things that needed to be changed and improved, that said to me, you got a lot of work because you got to stand up against all of these different things that you see out here. And that's what gave rise to me wanting to find a way by which I could work on getting rid of all of the things that was unfair, all of the things that were unjust, in an effort to try to create a fair and just society.
Well, you know, on some level, that seems so obvious superficially, and yet in the world of white supremacy, for a Black father to say that to a Black son was a revolutionary concept. Do you think so?
I know it was revolutionary, because to me, I knew my father was saying to me, you need to see all people as people, not prioritizing and having one group with priorities and another group not having that. So I'm knowing that was revolutionary, because I also had the opportunity to experience where when you step outside the status quo, so to speak, or you get out of line, serious things happen. Saw things happening not only with Black people, but also I saw a situation where it was a white man decided that he was going to change the pay scale for everybody that worked for him. Instead of paying them $3 per day, he was going to start paying them 75 cents per hour, and he was ostracized.
What was the impact of Emmett Till on you? How old were you when it happened, if I could ask?
I think I'm real close to Emmett Till's age. What?
So am I, 1955. Okay. I was born in 41.
So we were born in the same year. I was born in that same year.
And that shook me deeply even. That was one of the turning points in my life. So we're about the same age. Mm-hmm. We're 14, 15. Emmett is 15. What was the impact on you?
It impacted me tremendously, because it was one of those things where all of these things that you've heard about, you know, that you didn't exactly believe, now you know those things are real possibilities. And if it happened to him at that age, then there's a possibility that it might be happening to me. So I have to look at this thing in a different manner rather than the children versus the older people, but this thing applies all across the board. So it created a little bit of fear, a little bit of ambivalence in me as to where I could be safe and where I perhaps had stepped across the line, and even started trying to figure out how I'll make sure I didn't step across the line. But I realized that to do and be the kind of person my father had told me to be, I was going to have to step across the line.
Well, what was your introduction to SNCC? What role did you play in its formation? Where did you come in its early stages?
I came in to SNCC after SNCC was rolling.
Okay.
SNCC had been formed. That participated in sit-in demonstrations and all of that, came in to Mississippi through Bob Moses in 1961, working on voter registration. So a friend girl of mine came and told me that Dr. Martin Luther King and some other big folks with Zim Bacomb, you know, right, having meetings with people. She told me where it was being held and all that. So I snatched up my best three buddies and told them, so look, man, so Dr. Martin Luther King is out here in town having a meeting with folks, so let's go meet with him, see what he got to say, see what he's talking about. So I snatched up my three best friends, and we went on out to Macomb looking for Martin Luther King. And when we got to where she had told us Martin Luther King was, I found Bob Moses. When I walked up, I didn't know who he was, so I walked up and asked him, look, man, say, you Martin Luther King? And he said, no, I'm not. He said, you know, in his little sort of way, I'm Bob. Bob who? Bob Moses. So I asked him, well, what are you doing here? I said, I'm looking for Dr. King. So he explained to me that he was there working on voter registration, and I asked him what all was involved. So he explained all of that process to me and asked if I would be interested in joining up with him. And I told him, yeah. So that's what I did, began to work with Bob and getting people to come out to the office where he was teaching them how to fill out the voter registration forms in order to become registered voters, and just kept on keeping on.
So as you were saying this morning, every historical moment is preceded by a different historical moment, and we can all go seriously back to the early slave rebellions. But what was unique about 1964? There is a time in history when history just gets accelerated at such a rapid rate. So we had the voter registration, the killing of Mickey Schwerner and Goodman and Cheney. I just realized the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party fight, all in a 4-month period. What was it like for you? What role were you playing at that moment?
Being a sneak person, I was involved in all aspects of that, trying to motivate, inspire, and push the further development of the Freedom Democratic Party, trying to continue to make sure that we continue to register people to vote, preparing for the 1964 summer project, which was coming into Mississippi, knowing that we're bringing people into Mississippi that has not been here before, so therefore you're going to have to be responsible for them. You know, as a young person at that particular time, I think I was sent 23 or 24 different volunteers. Here you are responsible, as I saw, for the lives of 23 people who've never been to Mississippi, that know nothing about Mississippi,
right,
which is a daunting task. So that's what I had to prepare for. That's why I set up certain ground rules in order to work in the Holmes County. And you're working on all of these different fronts at the same time, because you're constantly trying to develop relationships and building a movement to develop a relationship.
What was your relationship with Fannie Lou Hamer at that time?
I was one of the ones, I guess you could say, that helped to invite Fannie Lou Hamer into the movement, because Amza Moore was the one that told us, said, I got a lady I need y'all to meet. Her name was Fannie Lou Hamer. You know, and if you can get her, you got a good one. He carried us to where she was involved in a singing program, introduced us on the break, and then we were invited to stay to the end of the program and could come by her house and talk with her further as a part of that. So that's what we did. I was one of those that went and talked with her from the onset, and she agreed to be involved, and that's how I first got a chance to meet and know Fannie Lou Hamer.
Well, that's a pretty great way to start, right? As you can modestly say, you helped to recruit Fannie Lou Hamer, and that's amazing in itself, both being yourself and Fannie Lou Hamer. I was deeply influenced by her, which I'll tell you in a minute, because I want to get to Atlantic City. She talked to us afterwards about Atlantic City, but tell us about the Atlantic City experience. Were you in the debates about the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party compromise, the so-called compromise that the Democrats offered?
I was a part of that debate. For the most part, I did a little debating and put forth my ideas and my suggestions. But I've always been one who, when you got some folks that's winning the fight, don't you take them out in order for you to get in. You be ready to jump in if it look as if they're getting tired and may not be throwing the blows that they would needed to be throwing. So I was there, did a little bit of talking as a part of that, but from all indications to me, Fannie Lou Hamer and a few of the other folks, they got this thing covered. They're not going to give an inch, not willing to back up, and not willing to accept anything that would jive, which we thought the compromise was jive.
Well, I think one of the reasons the compromise was jive for our listeners is, as Fannie Lou Hamer explained to us in Newark, New Jersey, about 4 months later, she said, well, the Democrats came to us, Lyndon Johnson, Hubert Humphrey, Walter Reuther, Bayard Rustin, and started pressuring us and telling us that if we want to defeat Goldwater, if we want to get Hubert Humphrey to be vice president, we have to take the compromise where we will get, we being the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, two at-large seats with no votes, right, and they will seat the white, all lily white Democrats. So she said to us, remember two things. Compromise is not a bad word, as long as you know that one side wins the compromise and the other side loses. So if you get a winning compromise, you can use the word compromise. But there was no compromise there. It was a pure defeat. Second thing she said is, if you negotiate, you better be able to go home and look the people in the eye who you represented and said, I fought tooth and nail for you.
That's right.
I got you everything I could. You may not agree with it, but this is truly the best that was historically possible. And she said, I was no way was I going back to Mississippi with that deal.
And she had said those very words as a part of the quote-unquote debate.
Right.
Over whether we do that. She said to us, look, I got to go back home to my people in Mississippi. I cannot go even myself with a straight face and tell them I did and accepted what is being offered. And she just let it be known, no way, no way. And we backed that position. No way. We'd rather go back and tell this is where the folks are. They caved in on us, didn't stand with their commitment. So we don't have anything as a part of this process.
Well, let me ask you this. In that Aaron Henry and Ed King did accept that compromise. What was the relationship like after that?
Well, see, after that whole thing, you had an agreement where people decided that they're going to straighten out the Democratic Party, and instead of that, we're going to create the loyalist Democrats, you know, and it was going to do certain things. So this other organization did come in to being, where Aaron and another guy from Quitman County became co-chairs of the Loyalist Democrats. And the Loyalists accepted and promoted most of the things that we were pushing and fighting for as a part of the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party. And that ultimately led to the complete deterioration of the Mississippi Democrat Party as a statewide organization. They start accepting and saying there's no need for us since the Loyalists is doing this, and one by one began to fall off.
So the issue throughout history of co-optation has been a tremendous problem of social movements, which is the social movement pushes the boundary, the system says no, but then realizes, well, perhaps a few people and a few compromises and holding your team together after that. Did you move in the direction of either, you know, the Lowndes County Freedom Organization politics? What direction did you take after MFDP non-compromise in 1964? What happened to you?
Well, staying here in Mississippi, continuing to carry on the work, when I would talk to people, I would express my feeling and my opinion about that. And in most cases, people saw and understood that. And when they were told about the makeup of the Loyalist Democratic Party, many of them would ask me, say, well, how are these white folks gonna be so much different from the other white folks just because they allow people to hold one or two positions don't mean that they right. have any power or control of anything. So I couldn't deny that. I couldn't attempt to argue for the other side. Say, well, I understand what you're saying, and my position, you know, is the same as that. And I continue, you know, to do some mobilizing and some organizing folks to the best extent that I could. And at the same time, during that period of time, you also found not just the Freedom Democratic Party being dissolved, but also you found the strength and people involved in the national four major organizations begin to vanish and evacuate Mississippi.
Did you stay?
I've been here. I stayed. I'm still staying.
They come, they go, and you stay.
They come, they go, and I stay. And part of my staying has to do with me understanding that the work that needed to be done back then still need to be done today. So there's much work that need to be done. So I hang around, do whatever I can, attempt to build organization or build people that will build organization that will carry on the work that need to be done.
I heard you working with Southern Echo, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm the president and founder of Southern Echo.
So I guess you are working with them then. Well, let me ask you a question then. I think that you should play a real role as a historian.
Think as a very real role, okay.
I mean it, because Mumia Abu-Jamal was on my radio show, and we're talking about, came up with the concept of menticide, where a whole new generation of black youth in particular have lost their history and are totally disoriented. And I think that the talk you gave today was so moving. And I knew a lot of that. I've studied a lot of that. But then I didn't know a lot of that. It's infinitely knowable. And how much are you doing teaching of black history to young people today?
It's growing every year. Now some of it comes through doing it with organization and their staff and constituents. And more it's beginning to take place with colleges and schools, high school. So it's continuously increasing. And that's one of the things that I have realized for a number of years is that being able to share and teach people about that history. It's just like the young people that sang with me this morning.
I saw that.
You know, the young lady that started that group, I've been working with her ever since she was 13. And see, now she's a grandmama.
Wow. My last question is, what do you think is the greatest contribution of the Obama administration? And what do you think is the greatest challenge to the Obama administration from the black community?
The greatest contribution for the black community coming from him being elected is just that.
Right.
Him being elected, proving and showing that a black person can become elected. How and what they have to do and all of that kind of thing, that's a whole other
right.
different
right.
monster. But at least he proves that black person can get elected, you know, because the old myth and everything said a black person could never be
that's
elected
right.
president, blah, 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 one of those things. So that is his greatest contribution. The greatest challenge coming from the black community, as far as I see, is black people look at, in most of his conversations, his talks, his speeches, and all of that, is he never, for the most part, he don't talk about us.
That's right.
Don't talk about us, and he don't talk about a class of folks that some of us is a part of. You know, is the poor.
That's right.
We talk about somebody else. And the biggest challenge is, how can you continue to support someone that's not espousing to that which you need, that which you about? And that makes it very, very difficult to black people. And they ultimately have to revert back to a position that we shouldn't have to revert back to, and that is to accept the lesser of two evils. We know what these are going to do. We don't know what this one is going to do. He might. So it's in our best interest to go with might rather than going with the one that we know is not going to do this, or not going either way and leave it up to chance that the lesser of two evils will win. But in many instances, the lesser of two evils end up not winning. So you have the worst case scenario.
Well, I think if Fannie Lou Hamer was here and Hollis Watkins, who is here, I think we are saying that there's still a need for an independent black politics, an independent black politics that's going to reach out to all other classes and races, and it's going to have to be to the left of President Obama. Is that a fair assertion, or would you say it differently?
I think that's a fair assertion, and that's how some of us are beginning to look at things at a local level. We haven't talked about it to a great extent, you know, on a statewide level, but in local counties where we're working with different groups of people, we're saying, hey, look, you know, if we can't completely take over and run this thing that we're calling Democrat or whatever, then we're going to have to create another thing that is ours, because if we're going to get the effect and the support and the help we need, we're going to have to be the one that's sitting at the helm of things.
Well, I think getting another thing that is ours is a wonderful way to end this conversation, Hollis Watkins. You're really a pleasure to be with. Come to Los Angeles and teach black history to a bunch of black, Latino, white, and Asian kids. I mean it. And I'll be coming back to Southern Echo, and it's a real honor having you on Voices from the Frontlines. So this is Eric Mann, very deeply moved by this Mr. Hollis Watkins. I've listened to every word he said. I listened to him sing this morning. Then I listened to him preach. Then I listened to him teach history. And now I've listened to him have a really wonderful conversation about history, starting with his own father and ending with the future. And you can't do much better than that. So from Jackson, Mississippi, this is Eric Mann on Voices from the Frontlines. And it may be old, but it's still good. All power to the people.